the Harvard University, where he is the Anne Wang Professor of Computer Science and Electrical Engineering in the Division of Engineering and Applied Science. So he is the founder of the Harvard Robotics Lab and the director of the Center for Dynamics and Control of Smart Structures. So he has of his many awards and honors, he's a member of the National Academy of Engineers, fellow of the IEEE, Guggenheim Fellow, etc. So made huge contributions to automatic control theory, design of smart structures, dynamical systems, robotics, and computer vision. So it gives me great pleasure to introduce Roger Brocken, and let's give him a warm welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Michael. Good afternoon. I have laser pointers and all kinds of technology things here, which I can't find. This talk is going to be a mixture of a whole lot of things, and I hope that doesn't put people off too much, but there you have it. So what I'm going to do is go back and forth a bit between things that are rather prosaic and things that are a bit mathematical. And this outline suggests a part that will be somewhat non-mathematical and then some more mathematical stuff and a mixed bag from then on. There'll be some mathematical ideas which I isolated here. I must say that I don't know so much about you folks and the audience that I might anticipate, so I thought it would be a good idea, since Michael told me that this is the Institute for Applied Mathematics, I should say something about, is there any mathematical content in this talk? And so there are some things here, some ideas from the theory of Lie algebras and normal metrics and so forth, some things that border on numerical analysis, but which will be more closely related to wave-like phenomena, some bits about completely integral Hamiltonian systems, and some recent observations that I've made about non-smooth manifolds and how they constrain the solutions of differential equations in useful ways, and then a particular control problem that I'll talk about at the very end. So, what it seems to me as I look around the applied mathematical world these days is that the problems that people used to mention at the end of their papers about, well, of course, the differential equation changes when something happens, or there are some discrete phenomena that are involved, or some of the data is really quantized. Instead of treating those effects as being of secondary importance or to be washed away, it seems to me that people are taking on more squarely questions in which quantized information plays a role. And of course, digital systems are a big example, and all the digital equipment from cell phones to slot machines to any kind of automobile control these days are, in essence, deal with quantized data. They don't deal with real numbers. And then in the dynamics of cells, where in fact the number of proteins required to keep a single cell in operation are something like the order of 5,000, and you have 5,000 ordinary differential equations that discuss model the promoters that tell a transcription process to turn off and turn on, and then you have this relationship between the purely discrete transcription process and the analog processes that initiate that. Then you have problems in natural information processing, such as speech recognition, where you hear a pressure wave of something and you say, ah, yes, that's the word something. And that, again, is the idea of where you're trying to convert from analog world to digital world, and then if you're having a conversation, convert back again. So oftentimes these are thought of as systems of differential equations with strong discontinuities in the right-hand side, such as signum of X minus A or some vector version of that. But what I want to show in this talk is that it doesn't have to be that way, that there's many kinds of processes that we'd ordinarily think of as being discrete or discontinuous, which in fact are governed by smooth differential equations, and it's in some sense more persuasive to write models of that kind. So, first idea is that there's not a sharp distinction between trajectories that are achievable with continuous ordinary differential equations or partial differential equations and ones that are achievable by discontinuous systems. I'm going to try to illustrate that for you with problems from this list of things here. And so here's a specific question for you to think about. And I apologize to people on that side of the room. Must be a terrible angle. You can't see my lovely colors either. Anyway, suppose that you wanted to take a list of numbers here, 5, 1, 6, 8, 3, use them as initial conditions for components of a differential equation, find the differential equation in such a way that the largest of these went to the first number, the next largest went to the next, and so on. So that you generated a flow that sorts this list of numbers. So one thinks of sorting as being a very, very discrete thing, right? You got to compare. Now, can it possibly happen that a differential equation will do this? All right, so the answer is, that I'll show you in a second, is yes, but in order to do it, we'll need to introduce some swap space, that is to say, some temporary holding space for the variables that are being sorted. Much as if you know about bubble sort as a very simple and not terribly efficient algorithm for doing sorting, whereby you switch entries in a list, this neighbor by neighbor switching goes on, and let the largest value bubble to the top. This is a bit like that, because in that bubble sort, you also have to have some swap space. All right, so here's a set of differential equations that, in fact, will sort a list of numbers. It's set up so that one will sort n numbers. The numbers will be the initial conditions on the x's, x1, x2, xn. And this set of equations will flow until the largest one is in x1, or the next largest in x2, and so forth. And in fact, the network to do this is not very complicated, but first of all, I'll show you how it works. So this is the solution to this differential equation. You can see that you're getting some pairwise sorting here. It's easy to see toward the end. It's a little bit mixed up here at the beginning. But notice that as time evolved here, 0 to 50, that we sorted this list, and bring out the structure of those differential equations in a little bit different way. So there they are, written as you might do it in a math book, and here they are as written as you might see them in an electrical engineering book, whereby you see the x's being driven by the neighboring y's, and you see the y's being driven by the neighboring x's. So this whole signal flow diagram, everything is nearest neighbor coupling, much as you'd expect a continuous version of bubble sort to be. So, to again emphasize what happened there, we had an initial order of 4, 6, 2, 7, 1, 3, 5, 3. Final order was the natural order. And so we needed to generate this permutation matrix. So from one point of view, you could say, how can a set of differential equations generate one of the 7-factorial possible permutation matrices required to permute the initial condition into the final condition? Since most people find this a little bit fast, I'm going to show it to you once more. Yeah. Isn't that remarkable? You've got to admit that's remarkable.
It has a mean equilibrium state?
It has, in fact, n factorial equilibrium states. All of our saddle points, except for the one that is produces the right sort.
Does it mean that you have an angel of equation?
I will show you in a minute or two that this is, in fact, can be thought of either as a lossless Hamiltonian system that is has n conserved quantities, i.e. it's completely integrable, or it can be thought of as a gradient flow with respect to a potential function. Yes.
So you're showing us seven variables there.
Yes.
And I assume that in those times the moons all look stable, the y's, these are the x's and the y's are changing here in a sense?
That is a correct statement. The y's start off being very small. They end up being very small. But like the swap space and bubble sort, in the meantime, they go through big excursions. So the y's are really just helping carry things along. And I'll give you some more insight into this in a second. But remember, we generated that permutation matrix by a differential equation. Okay, so what provides the discontinuous effect here? The right-hand side of those differential equations with nothing except multiplication. They were all quadratic right-hand sides. So what's going on? How can we produce this very sensitive comparison process from ordinary differential equations? Well, hyperbolic points, I've shown them here as if they were two-dimensional. In fact, in the example, they were all seven-dimensional. But the sort of the canonical form for hyperbolic points, simplified slightly, is one variable is unstable, dx dt equals x. The other variable is stable, dy dt equals minus y. So that means that incoming tube of trajectories are thrown down upon this axis here, and depending on whether they go to the right or the left, their future is very different. If they come in on this side, they go over here. Now, if you cascade these hyperbolic points together, every time it goes past a hyperbolic point, it makes some discrete judgment. Depending upon arbitrary sensitivity, depending on how close it is to the separatrix here, and then it can come out and it can go down another one, and that can chain together with another one, another one, another one. So if I have, as I have here, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, this could make a choice of 1 out of 2 to the 5th choices. And these knife edges that split the flow effectively produce a comparison that makes that process work. Now, I want to confess that if you allowed discontinuities, then there would be a very much simpler solution to this problem. Suppose you had a number of masses sitting on a frictionless plane like this, and that these had velocities 6, 5, 3, 1, 8. And they're all positive heading east. And now you ask yourself, what's the final steady state of this thing? Well, of course, the fast ones are going to catch up with the slow ones. And when they do, if you assume perfect collision, they will exchange their velocities. And so when 6 runs into 5, 5 will take over 6's velocity, 6 will take over 5's velocity, and the 6 will have moved over to here. It catches up with 3, changes velocity again, catches up with the 1, changes again if the 3 hasn't caught up to 1 already. And ultimately, what you'll find is these things are heading with the same velocities they had to begin with. Now, this is a solution that's easy to see, and it was Toda's great wisdom to see that the interaction did not have to be a perfect collision in order to preserve the velocities the way this model does. But in fact, you could have a certain kind of potential, certainly by no means all potentials, but some potentials, and Toda worked with an exponential potential, that also ends up preserving the velocity. So it's a key thing about this operation is that some things should be preserved and some things should change. All right, now I'm going to give you a second example of something discrete that, that can be done by a dynamical system. So here's a pretty common problem in computer science, is that you have points that you would like to cluster together. So when you cluster together things, as biologists do, and people do when they assign letter grades to students' performance, they take groups and put them together and they cluster them. But the clustering process has various scales to it, and you might cluster this data together in at least these six ways that I talked about here. You'd have one which is every element's its own cluster. You have another one out here in which you have three clusters. At the end, you might have one cluster. So can you do that with a dynamical system? All right, so there's a... This one goes slower, so you can see it better. And at the end... So here, what have I done here? I've taken the numbers 1098, 654, and 1, and I have asked the machine to cluster those. You don't know what this matrix up here means, but that's a 7x7 matrix that is changing values in a way that I'll tell you about in a little bit. But you can see we generated this clustering tree by letting things that were close to each other flow together, and eventually they decided what else was close to each other, and they flowed together as well. So, again, a discrete process done in something of the same way. Just to reiterate, we had 9, 10, 8, 6, 5, 4, 1, and it was clustered at an early stage into three groups, like so, at a later stage into two groups, and finally, it was clustered as a single. Okay, so that's the end of part one, and my hopes for that were modest, is that I've given you some reason to believe that differential equations, even very smooth ones, quadratic functions, can do things that you might have thought of as requiring discontinuous stuff. Now,
Did those records really coalesce, or did they were just close?
Well, they approach each other exponentially. Same with the previous one. And furthermore, I mean, you might find this amusing. If you ask people to sort the lengths of lines, so put lines on a computer screen, and you say, press a key depending on which line's shorter and so forth and so on. So as you might imagine, if the lines are very close to each other, it takes longer than if the lines are obviously different. In this case, the exponential convergence depends upon the difference between the things being sorted. If it's faster, if they're farther apart, slower if they're not. Yes?
How long does it take if sort of bubble sort you estimate how many operations? How many operations would it take if you had a list of n in your first example to sort it? Is it long in n? Is it by the ODE?
Well, as you may know, there isn't any universally accepted complexity theory that works with real numbers. And so since in theory these differential equations are working with real numbers, I don't know exactly how to answer that question. What I can do is I can tell you the exponential rate of convergence, but I am at loss to assess the computational complexity. In neither of these examples does it. Okay, so now I want to. So that was the easier part. And now what I want to do is give a little bit of the math background behind these things. In fact, the two equations that I showed and everything I will talk about today are closely related to this equation in symmetric matrices, which I'm calling H on this slide. And H has a derivative, which is pretty simple. It's h squared n minus 2hnh plus nh squared. Or, if you allow me to use this bracket notation, whereby a bracket b is, what the hell? I have no idea what I was writing there. A bracket b equals ab minus ba, is what I meant to say there. Then this can be written as h dot equals h bracket n. turns out that clearly this equation will flow in the space of symmetric matrices. It's not hard to show that that quantity is symmetric. Just take the transpose of this, you see, you get it back again. Provided n is symmetric, so n is a arbitrary constant symmetric matrix in this case. It's not so clear, but if you restrict this to the space of tri-diagonal matrices and make a special choice of n, namely n should be diagonal with the numbers 1, 2, 3, down the, etc., down the diagonal, then this equation will also flow on the space of tri-diagonal matrices. And when this flows, anything that is of the form H bracket, any old thing here, what happens is that that's sort of an infinitesimal similarity transformation, so that the spectrum of H does not change. Eigenvalues of H remain invariant as this equation flows, and hence are always equal to the initial eigenvalues of H. And there's various generalizations of this. In fact, the equation that generated the clustering algorithm, it looks like H bracket, and then the diagonal of H commutes with H is the way you generate that flow. And it's also true that in some of the interesting cases, this fact that the eigenvalues are preserved along this flow is what makes it possible for the original values not to get lost. And they also, you want them not, it'd be disappointing to end up at the end with something sorted, but it wasn't your original list. So you must keep those things in memory somehow. And the memory is occurring as conserved quantities in a differential equation. Okay, so now I'm going to try something quite ambitious. I'm going to just tell you a few words. Some of this is not so familiar to you. I suspect that that one cannot actually make believers out of you very quickly, but I will try. So, a Lie group. It's a group, first of all, and it's a continuous group, and it's a topological space, and multiplication and inversion are continuous, and a number of people got quite famous for verifying Hilbert's conjecture that continuity meant differentiability in this context, and it does. So think of the group as being a group of matrices, like the orthogonal group. Group of n by n orthogonal matrices, or the group of n by n non-singular matrices, both of those are just fine Lie groups. A group is said to act on a differentiable manifold X by some group action, which I'll denote by the letter phi. And what that means is you take an element of the group, you take an element of the manifold, you put them together into this function phi, and you get a new element of the manifold. And it has to have this compositional property. Anything you'd want to write down that made any sense would have that property, so I won't belabor it. And in particular, a matrix Lie group acts on its differentials or its Lie algebra by similarity transformation. So, for example, if we have the group of orthogonal matrices, then that's closely related to the group of skew symmetric matrices in the sense that E to a skew symmetric matrix is orthogonal. And I take the skew symmetric matrix here and I sandwich it between G inverse and G. And this is a similarity transformation whereby the group takes an element of its own algebra and transforms it into something else. But because this is a similarity transformation, it means that I didn't change the eigenvalues of L in that process. So, associated with every Lie group is a Lie algebra, and we can think of it as describing how G looks in a small set around the identity. So by exponentiating L, if everything's a matrix, as we can take it to be here, E to the L gives us an element of G, and a small neighborhood of the origin in L space gives us a small neighborhood of the identity in G space. Abstract definition, it just looks like a vector space with some multiplication. Multiplication has to be skew symmetric and satisfy this Jacobi identity. All right, main things to think about: examples, Lie algebra with the orthogonal group is the set of skew symmetric matrices of the same dimension. The Lie bracket operation is simply this omega 1 omega bracket omega 2 is omega 1 omega 2 minus omega 2 omega 1.
Is this bracket different from the bracket 2 pi before? That minus AB because
it's
the A.
It was that typographical mistake on my slide. Sorry. What I should have said there was A bracket B equals AB minus BA. That's what I meant right there. Sorry. Okay. Now, one last annoying thing here is that let theta be an orthogonal matrix and let Q be a symmetric matrix with fixed with a set of eigenvalues, lambda 1 through lambda n. When theta alters Q by theta transpose Q theta, then of course we have what I was talking about before, the group of orthogonal matrices is acting on the group of symmetric, on the set of symmetric matrices, and this set SYM of lambda 1 through lambda n is my notation for the set of symmetric matrices with these fixed eigenvalues. This is a manifold. It's nice, smooth. It can be shown that it's locally Euclidean space and all that good stuff. And it's a dimension of the same dimension of the space of skew symmetric matrices, namely n times n minus 1 over 2. Okay, now by an orbit, what you mean is you take this Lie algebra, elements, let's say, are n by n matrices. Lie group, whose elements are non-singular n by n matrices, the map that takes us a element of the Lie algebra and exponentiates it, sends the Lie algebra into the group of invertible matrices. This fact that P inverse e to the LP, you can take the similarity transformation and push it upstairs. This defines a way in which the group acts on the algebra, a general way, and it fits with our definitions that we gave before. And the language that I might slip into occasionally involves the word adjoint, and the way that the word adjoint gets used in Lie algebra theory is different than the way it gets used in operator theory, which is different from the way it gets used in matrix theory, et cetera, et cetera. But so I'll tell you what it is here. The adjoint operator, it works as follows. Is that for any element of the Lie algebra, I can commute it with an arbitrary thing. So the operator L1 comma bracket is a linear transformation of L into itself. Therefore, since it maps the space into itself, it has eigenvalues. And if I take and iterate L1 with L2, then this still defines a linear transformation, and it still has eigenvalues. And the sum of these eigenvalues is a special thing called the Killing form on the Lie algebra. It's a bilinear form. So it's linear in L1, linear in L2. And it, for our... The only example that I'm really going to talk about is this skew symmetric matrices thing. And in that case, this is a negative semi-definite quadratic form in the Lie algebra. And Killing defined this thing in the 1880s and got him on the map of science forever.
So we fix L1 and L2. We have like one layer of transformation. The eigenvalues of that layer of transformation.
Exactly.
The trace of that linear map is the Killing form.
Yes. And the miracle is that in the case of skew symmetric matrices, or in fact any Lie algebra where that meets these two more or less benign conditions, that is actually a negative definite quadratic form. Takes a little showing. Okay, now I'm also going to require one additional gadget, namely something called the normal metric, or sometimes called the Einstein metric. And this will be very important for seeing these things as a gradient flow. So, if I ask somebody what they would propose as a way to measure distance on the space of symmetric matrices, I suspect that most people would say, well, let's take the square root of the sum of the squares of the differences between the entries. And some people would call that the Frobenius metric. And it's certainly the first thing you would think of. We will not use this. This is not suitable for our purposes. So remove that from your mind. We're looking for a metric on the space of symmetric matrices with a given set of eigenvalues. This norm does not respect eigenvalues in any way. Eigenvalues don't play a particular role in it. So I'm going to describe for you a new metric. And the metric is going to be motivated as follows. So we have a gadget, Q. And I'd be interested in knowing how far Q is from H. They're both symmetric matrices. And they both have the same eigenvalues. Now, if they have the same eigenvalues, then that means that I can find an orthogonal matrix that takes Q into H. How big is that orthogonal matrix? Well, how far is that orthogonal matrix from the identity? If I write the orthogonal matrix as e to the omega, where omega is a skew symmetric matrix, then I can measure that by measuring the size of omega. In fact, I'll use the Frobenius norm on omega. So this is like using Frobenius norm on the logarithm rather than on the matrix itself. And if you push through that point of view, which says Q is as close to H as the smallest size exponential that I require to make Q into H, then what happens is that instead of getting the Frobenius norm, where you would have just dHij quantity squared if you wrote it as a Riemannian metric, here, this has the effect of dividing by the difference between the eigenvalues. So that means already now that we are going to prefer systems with eigenvalues with different, so this denominator is never zero. And you see that we're not going to need to change the diagonals at all, because that would be a case where this was infinite. But instead of dh squared measuring the size, it's dh divided by lambda I minus lambda j. And that defines near the origin the normal metric and lets you get a feeling for it. Okay, so now we're going to go, things are going to get easier from now on. Gradient flows. So let Q and N be symmetric matrices, and let psi of H be a real valued function on this space of matrices, symmetric matrices with a given set of eigenvalues. Now, for example, psi might be the trace of H times a constant or some other function. What is the gradient of CH? Now, of course, the gradient, as sometimes people get taught in an elementary course, they just say, well, the gradient's just the vector of partial derivatives. But that's not the official definition of the gradient, of course. You have to, if you mean gradient to be the direction of steepest descent or steepest ascent, then you need to take into account how you measure distance, which is by the Riemannian metric. So the real gradient flow is x dot equals g inverse times the matrix of a vector of partial derivatives. If we do that to our problem with this normal metric, it turns out that this is the way you write the gradient flow, is that h dot equals h bracket times the matrix of partial derivatives. Very big difference as compared with what would happen with the Frobenius metric. So, point made in this slide is that if we took the trace of Hn relative to the Frobenius metric, then the gradient flow would just be dH dt equals n, which is a completely dumb and uninteresting differential equation. But if we use the normal metric, then dH dt is h bracket n, which is a wonderfully sweet equation.
That's the gradient flow for the same function, gradient H.
Yes, thank you. Okay, now, let's see if I can make this play. Well, no, 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 what's going on here? Here I'm showing you the solution of a solution of that equation, h bracket n, where I have started off the matrix with the matrix in diagonal form, and it has flowed in such a way that the diagonals take on the ordered value 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. You have certainly not remembered what the initial value was. So I'll go back to it. So now you see the initial value here was 4627153, and this flow that you just saw, this one, is sorting this thing. And furthermore, now you see that the whole process is done after just 2.5 units of time. Why is that? It's because I've allowed the matrix in this case to be full. I've allowed interconnections between 1 and 7 directly through this element, or this and this element, and I haven't restricted it to be this kind of bubble sort thing where you can only interchange nearest neighbors. So now you could ask, is this, what's the computational complexity of this? We've increased the number of interconnections, but we've reduced the speed from, it was 40 before, now into down to 2. A little bit more.
Is the function of trace of HN?
Yeah.
And this N?
N is the 1, 2, 3, 4 diagonal operator. Again, it doesn't have to be that, but that is what it was. All right, so another 15 minutes has gone by. And so I tried to give a very, very quick overview, mentioning some of the words that are needed to make these ideas provable and to understand them. But what now I'd like to do is to give some more concrete indication of the broader scope of this kind of thinking. How can this be useful in some more applications, or at least inspire your imagination? So I'm going to, before I had the total lattice up there, and now I'm going to add two terms that were absent before. The things in the red boxes were absent before. I've added one more swap space equation, yn, and I've added two terms, and now the lattice is completely symmetrical. It's given by this equation, just repeated n times, where we agree to interpret the subscripts modulo n. So this is an equation in which you can visualize these various units here as living on a n-gon, and they talk to their nearest neighbors. Periodic total lattice. Periodic total lattice is now no longer a gradient flow. It still is a integrable Hamiltonian system. It has n conserved quantities, but it is not anymore a gradient flow. Its partner is no longer the tridiagonal matrices, as it would have been the case for the total lattice I talked about before. But now we have to add these elements in the 1n and n1 position. So we've added two more parameters. And people call these things periodic Jacobi matrices, but there's nothing periodic about them except for the fact that this term yn and yn, those terms are present. And so it's periodic in the sense that all the entries now have two nearest neighbors, the nth entry and the first entry are now neighbors and connected the same way everybody else is. So if you commuted this bicyclically, it wouldn't change. All right. And if these terms are absent, that is, if yn is zero, these are called Jacobi matrices. And the corresponding total lattice is usually called the aperiodic total lattice, whereas the periodic total lattice is the thing I put up before. Okay. The main reason for, so you say, what are you, nuts or something? We had a perfectly good set of equations I didn't need any matrices, and I didn't need any Lie algebras or anything else to talk about it. Perfectly nice little set of equations. And now, for God knows what reason, you've gone and talked about them in terms of matrices. But there's a reason why. And that is that when you write these things in terms of matrices and you look at the equations of motion, now I'm going to talk about the periodic one, is the equations of motion now look like L dot equals, well, H dot or L dot, H dot equals H bracket BH or L dot equals L bracket BL, with BL being this matrix. So I can write down the periodic total lattice very simply in terms of matrices, and I can get this kind of economy of notation. That's one thing. But it's also true that any equation of this form, as I said before, preserves the eigenvalues of L. And that's really important because those act as the conserved quantities of a completely integrable Hamiltonian system, and they mean that if we're doing computations with this thing, the original data will not get lost because it's conserved by this thing. All right. So I talked about N before. This is a display of the N that I've been using most of the time. And this is repeating something that Brian asked about. But in fact, what I want to say is, to make a point that this is a gradient flow, is that d by dt of trace Ln in the aperiodic case is simply the square of, well, the Frobenius norm of L bracket N. So it's zero when L and N commute, that is when they're both diagonal, and it's otherwise it's not zero, and Ln is monotonically increasing. Okay, I want to go ahead here to a simulation. Alright, so this will not be a movie, but what I want to ask you to think about is, suppose that the initial condition on this total lattice was 1, 0, 0, 0. And it wants to sort this in such a way that the 1 is at the end, because let's say n is 1, 2, 3, 4 up to n, and the way to maximize that trace is to get the 1 over in this spot. So how does that work? Well, here I've shown the solution of the total lattice equation, not for the numbers that I showed before, but for a rather different situation now, where we have this initial condition and a lot of degeneracy here. What this shows is, and what you're going to see from your imagination, is that here we have x1, here's x2, here's x3, here's x4, x5, and so forth, plotted as a function of time. So first, the one is unhappy because he is bigger than his neighbor, or she is bigger than her neighbor to the right, and so it wants to exchange one and zero. So one comes down and two goes up. Then it's unhappy again because two is up and three is down. So then it trades energy with three and so forth. So this wave passes down the total lattice, and at the end, there's no one to complain about this being a one because there's no neighbor on that side. So it's happy. It comes down here like this. The last one goes high. Everything's happy at that point. In contrast, and believe it or not, I love this picture. So this is what happens when you make it a periodic total lattice. In that case, this is a perfect example of a lot of relationships in life. Nobody's happy ever. It's, everything goes as it did before. I've shown a longer time epoch here, but things are as they were before. One's not happy, two's not happy, so they interchange. Two's not happy, three's not happy, so they interchange. Come down to the interchange. They come down to the end, and now because the total lattice wraps around, it's not happy either. So it all goes back to one again, and we go down. So you think of a wave just going around the circle. Yes?
Are the fluctuations numerical or significant?
Okay, good question. So why is this wider than any of these people? And what would have been nicer if you'd ask, why, in spite of that change, do they come to the same height? So, two features. One is that this is clearly not a periodic solution in the sense that it each of these humps look the same, but that's not what periodicity would mean anyway, because it's an n-dimensional system. Could be periodic if this chain was exactly replicated over here. But you see, that doesn't happen either, because now, instead of being the 10th one that decides to be broad, over here it's the 9th one that decides to be broad, and the 10th one is back narrow again. And this is the 8th one, and that's the 7th one. But still, in spite of all that fooling around, they come back to the same height. Isn't that nice? Or at least worth remarking on. In fact, and this is partly for Mark's purpose, is that you can think of this as being an analog version of something that's a very popular structure in some parts of engineering, namely a recirculating digital delay line. That is to say, each of these Z's represent a delay of one unit, whatever that unit happens to be. And now if you imagine putting 10 of these in a row, and then you start this off with a pulse of the type I showed, then the pulse after one unit will be here, pulse after another unit will be here, and so forth and so on. So this looks like an analog version of a delay, a tap delay line that recirculates. These things are interesting because they are conceptual computational elements. And so if you wanted to say, I can build a computer in which there's nothing digital, but we do have these pulses laying around, you would want to have some standard building blocks, and this kind of a delay line would be one of the things that you might want to have. Okay. Now, the periodic and aperiodic total lattices propagate pulses. These lattices, the periodic and aperiodic case, are more or less the same as until you get to the wraparound, and then after you get past the wraparound, they look the same again. Propagating moving waves down the chain. The fact that the spectrum of the operator, the H, does not change means that the heights of these pulses will always be the same. It doesn't mean that these will be swept out with equal speed all the time, but it does force the height to be the same.
When you say the same, you mean as each other or as...
As each other.
Previous period?
No, well, that too. The peaks of the pulses are always the same.
But by breaking symmetry and coefficients, could you get those to be different from one to the next, but the same each?
Not for the particular initial condition 1000. So, a little bit betwixt and between here. I skipped a bunch of things, which I will go back and now talk about at least briefly. Periodic Jacobi matrices, always symmetric. So that's the place for the periodic total lattice, the source of your question. Now, this is actually a manifold if the eigenvalues are different from each other, pairwise distinct. It fails to be a manifold in the case where they are not pairwise distinct. And in fact, for the particular case that I talk about, when there's only one that's different and all the others are the same, this is in fact a one-dimensional C0 manifold, but it is not a differentiable manifold. This is a somewhat irregular object, but this solution is constrained to live on it forever. And that's why, as it goes around on this on its integral curve, it's got to pass through the same set of values all the time, but it doesn't have to traverse that curve with equal speed. So what you saw was a certain curve being traversed, but it traversed at different speeds. And that's why some of them were wider, some of them were not. Okay, I think I'm not going to try to tell you everything I know. So what I would say about this space of tridiagonal matrices is something that I think I can convey adequately, and that is, of course, in electronics or in naturally occurring neurological systems, there's always noise. And so to say that the eigenvalues are exactly 1,000 would be unrealistic. So you say, well, all right, it's within epsilon of that, measured in some topology, let's say by the Frobenius number, for example. So then you ask yourself, well, what does that space look like if, in fact, it's within epsilon of a Jacobi matrix, periodic Jacobi matrix, whose eigenvalues are 1,000, this one non-zero eigenvalue. Turns out you can study that thing, and it's kind of fun to do, and it looks like a circular link of sausage. Namely, it has some pinching off points where the manifold comes restricted, and then it has some broad points where you can't say as much about what the space looks like, and it just goes around repeatedly being pinched. The fact that it has to go through these narrow openings on a regular basis, it's forced to go through these narrow openings, provides this system with a kind of robustness. It's what forces the levels to come back to their fiducial value each time it goes through a pulse cycle. So this is an example of the topology of the manifold forcing properties of the solution and forcing robustness in ways that one would hope digital electronics people would find interesting, because it's a way to get robustness. All right, take me through that again. All right, so last little part, and I'll spend 5 minutes and then stop, is, so you say, find, so you've shown us some tricks with these total lattices and more general models, and you've hinted that they have something in common with some structures that are used in engineering. Can you build a theory or build a synthesis program out of these that could possibly be used to do information processing in some general way? Well, if you think about the way engineers think about such questions, is they always try to break the problem down into modules, and the modules get interconnected with each other, and you design the module more or less independent of the other one, or as independent as you can make it, and then put the things together, because that level of conceptualization lets you think about bigger problems. Fine. So in order to do that, we'd have to equip these total lattices with inputs and outputs. So what are the natural inputs for these things, and how do we alter those equations? Well, if you want to think of the input as coming at the front end of a total lattice, the natural thing to do is to add to the first x equation a u, and add to the first y equation a v times that y. I guess I'll ask you to take my word for that. Backing off from that point of view, which might be a little bit untenable. If you said to yourself, if I look at a periodic total lattice, how does the nth entry go back and feed into the first one? And if you look at it, you see it feeds in this way and this way. So it feeds into both the position coordinates and the momentum coordinates and through this way. So now we have a way to add inputs and outputs, inputs I've only shown here, to this total lattice. And so we can ask questions, well, all right, fine, you've got a total lattice sitting there, it's completely quiescent. What kind of input would you put into it in order to get one of these pulses going? Because I would like to be able to think of the input to this total lattice being the output of some other one, and so I could build systems in that way. And what I would like to do, if my operation of my system depends on pulse-like behavior, then I would like to know how should these inputs look in such a way as to produce pulses, as opposed to some horrible mishmash. All right, so here's a nice little question. It says here what I said before. Given U and V supported on some interval 0 to T, what eigenvalues do they initiate in the TOTA equations? So I go back to the previous slide. I put in U and V as some time functions, and I want to know what will be the eigenvalue. So in control theory, people talk about reachability questions. That is, they say, can I reach some state from using some input from a given state? And so, yes, fine. In an extreme case, if U and V are delivered at the same time as impulses, it's easy to just to set the initial conditions on these things. But that's not very realistic because impulses only exist in math books. So here is a guide that is, I'm sorry, this probably wasn't my finest moment here, but this big pulse here is the X pulse, that is, this would be the U in that previous thing, and these two neighboring Y pulses are the pulses that this first leading one here is one which, if you applied this as a Y pulse, this part, and this as an X pulse, slightly delayed from it, then you would initiate a 1-0-0-0-0 etc. eigenvalue situation. So these are the shapes of the inputs that will put you on this manifold of 1-0-0-0-ness, but you can do much more interesting things. You say, I don't want just a single pulse running down this line. Why don't you give me 4 or 5 pulses separated in time in a particular way? Because that way I can store more information in the line. What inputs would I use to put in a more elaborate pulse sequence? Well, that question could be answered as well, because you notice that the line, these sections are more or less decoupled from each other as long as you wait a respectable period. So if you wanted to put a 1 on the first one and a 1 on the third one, you could hit it with this, first of all, wait 2 units, and then hit it with another one, and that would give you the eigenstructure 1-1-0-0-0-0. So you can load this thing up with a variety of patterns, and you can think of coding information in patterns sitting on this delay line. Okay, well, what's the point? Solutions of smooth differential equations can exhibit behavior that's both surprising and robust. So, surprising, sortless of numbers. Robust, it's pinned in by the topology of the space where the differential equation lives, so it has no choice but to be robust. And this probably is, you may or may not be convinced about, but some ideas from differential geometry can be used to define the theoretical basis for understanding these things. The gradient flows, the Hamiltonian systems, the cojoint orbits, blah, 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 isospectral flows, all that went into that part that I went over rather quickly, but which is essential in coming to this point of view. Finally, by adding inputs and outputs to these models, then we laid the basis for a theory of interconnection, whereby we can interconnect these things and we can build systems that do interesting stuff. Thank you for your attention.